Hello and welcome along to the Northern Agenda podcast with me, Rob Parsons, a journalist based in Leeds who takes a closer look at politics in the north of England from outside the Westminster bubble. This week, I wanted to focus on the parts of the country where millions of us live, the so-called coalfield or ex-mining communities, and find out what the future holds for them. There's a new report out this week from the Coalfields Regeneration Trust setting out how the areas whose miners used to power industrial Britain are still lagging behind the big cities when it comes to jobs. But crucially, they have a vision for how they can catch up, and I spoke to Andy Locke from the charity to hear what needs to happen now. Stick around to listen to that in the second half of this episode. First though, there is a week to go until large parts of the north of England go to the polls on May the 2nd, and there's plenty on the line, not just in places like the Tees Valley and North East, which are electing metro mayors, but also towns and cities where control of local councils is at stake. But where are the most interesting races in the north, and why and how much do they matter? I'm very pleased to be joined today by Jonathan Carr-West, Chief Executive of the Local Government Information Unit, a not-for-profit organisation which produces a very helpful annual report on the local council elections to watch. Jonathan, welcome.
Hi, Rob. So great to be here.
Thanks for coming on. So I think it's fair to say 2024 has been described as the so-called year of elections. Obviously, we've got the general election coming up presumably at some point this year, the US presidential election as well, and a host of other elections around the world. Can you make the case for why people listening to this should pay attention to the local and mayoral elections coming up when we have lots of other higher profile elections later in the year?
Thanks, Rob. I think, because obviously a lot of the kind of media attention will be captured by the general election that we expect later this year, by the US election, by elections around the world. But actually, when you think about the consequences of elections, most of the things that most of us care about most days are run from the town hall or county hall or city hall, not from Whitehall. If you think about housing, are my kids going to have decent homes, decent jobs? Are there good schools? Is my neighborhood safe and clean? Is someone going to look after my aging relatives? You know, are kids, are vulnerable children in my community protected? Are children with special educational needs supported? You know, does transport work? All of these things are done by local government. So although local elections, I was going to say, get a bad press, don't get very much press, and are treated as a sort of, when they are talked about, are treated as a kind of glorified opinion poll. And, of course, only about 30-something percent of us turn out to vote in. Despite all that, actually, these elections are about electing councillors, people who will be making really tough decisions in some really tough times about the public services that we all rely on every day. So although local elections are often seen as sort of bottom of the pecking order in terms of elections, I'd argue they're actually the most important of all.
So it's May the 2nd, next Thursday, as this podcast goes out, when people will be voting. And obviously we want as many people to vote as possible. I get that message over loud and clear. But the one thing I've noticed is that I feel like it used to be the case that you'd get all the results in a much more concentrated span of time, like normally early on Friday, maybe a few during the day on the Friday. But this time round, and in the last couple, 2 or 3 years, they've been really spread out, haven't they? So we've got some overnight on Thursday into Friday, some more on Friday afternoon, then some others on Saturday, I think, and then the final results from places like Salford trickling in on Sunday. I suspect for journalists like me or anyone who likes to stay up all night to watch the results, that's a bit annoying. But there's a sort of practical reason for that, isn't there, in terms of the logistics of managing the counts?
It's exactly that. So, yeah, of course, it would be wonderful to get it all in one big bang, a sort of super, super story. But, you know, elections are run by people. And you know, we take elections for granted a bit. And it's great. It's great that we live in a country where we are able to be kind of blasé about electoral administration, but elections only work, they've got millions of moving pieces, and they only work because electoral services officers in councils are making them work. Now, one of the things you have to do, it sounds pretty obvious, you've got to count the votes. We've got a lot of different elections happening on May the 2nd. There's local council elections, there's mayoral elections in some places, Midlands, Tees Valley, for example, and everywhere in the country there are police and crime commission elections. So what that means is that in many areas they will be counting the votes on three separate sets of elections. So quite simply, that takes quite a long time, and you want people to get it right. So you don't want to be saying to the people who are doing that, right, you've got to stay up, go without sleep for 48 hours and just keep counting. You need to give them breaks. Resources are limited. We only have so many election administrators. The returning officer, normally, not always, normally the council chief exec, has to be awake and alert and monitoring the outcomes of, you know, the counting and the results of all of those elections. So you simply just can't do it all in one big go after 10 p.m. on Thursday. You have to give people breaks. You have to have rest. You have to sort of, you know, build enough space into the system to ensure that no mistakes are made. So it is just purely logistics. If you had millions more people working on it, you could do it quicker, but you don't.
Yeah, I do recall seeing the odd story about a returning officer calling the wrong person's name or some kind of mess up in the count. And I guess those kind of things are a lot more likely if the returning officer or the staff are very tired and have been on the go for 24 hours without sleep. It's only going to make those kind of mistakes more likely, isn't it?
Exactly. And believe me, they will be tired and they will have been on the go for 24 hours, but let's not make them be on the go for 3 days, because those things are really disastrous. If you get it wrong, it's a real problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned, Jonathan, the two of the elections that I think are getting the most national attention, the West Midlands and Tees Valley mayoral elections. And there's an interesting article I saw in The Eye, I think, by Sebastian Payne, who is the director of the Onward think tank, born in Gateshead, actually. He said, on 2nd of May, only two names will matter. The politics for the rest of 2024 will be defined by whether Conservatives Andy Street and Ben Houchin win third terms in the West Midlands and Tees Valley. I know it's quite a broad statement to make. I mean, would you agree with that? Are those the two elections that are exciting your interest the most?
I would agree up to a point. I mean, it depends what optic you view it from. I think probably for Rishi Sunak, that's true. You know, that if you're interested in the sort of national politics, what the impact is, particularly on the Conservative Party, what are the chances of a leadership challenge? What's the timing of the general election going to be? What's the outcome of that general election going to be? Then Andy Street and Ben Houchin are two really important bellwethers. And I think, you know, they're both looking like tighter races than people might once have thought. And I think it is true that if both of those incumbents lose, I think that will be seen, and this degree to which these things become self-fulfilling prophecies, that will be seen as a very bad result for the Conservative Party. Against that, I would go back to my earlier point to say, yeah, these elections aren't really about Rishi Sunak. They're not about the government. They are, you know, the important thing is who is going to be the mayor of the West Midlands. What policies are they going to introduce? How are they going to tackle crime, transport, inward investment? You know, so there are real things at stake. London mayoralty is, you know, who's the mayor of London? That really matters. If we're seeing it in the frame of sort of bigger party politics, I don't think they're the only things I would look out for. Again, it's moving away from your patch a bit, but I'm really interested to see what happens to the Lib Dem vote in the southeast. Are we going to? I don't think we'll see many councils changing control, but in terms of vote share, how the Lib Dems do in places, you know, in Surrey and, you know, those sorts of places, that is also, I think, going to be quite telling in terms of what we might expect in the general election. So I agree with Seb Payne up to a point, but there are other things we can look at and there are other issues at play.
Absolutely. Well, let's get into something a bit more specific in terms of the North, because as I say, the local government information unit does a very handy, for journalists like me, guide each year to the local elections to watch. And there's quite a few in the North of England. So we'll just go through the three regions in turn, if that's okay. Obviously, we know about the mayoral elections in the Northeast. You've got the Tees Valley, which we've mentioned, and the first Northeast Metro Mayor, which is an election we've covered quite a lot on this podcast. In terms of council races, are there any councils in the Northeast which are likely to change hands or could change hands?
Well, I mean, we say this every year, but Hartlepool, Hartlepool is perennially marginal council. It's been a bellwether seat for some years now. Both, and importantly, both in council elections and parliamentary elections, council's been under no overall control since 2019. Labour made quite a lot of gains last year in 2023. This year, they only need two more seats to put them in full control of the council. So Hartlepool is one where you could see a change in control in the council. So that is of, you know, that is of real significance to the people of Hartlepool, because you will get different leaders, different policies. But it's also, I suspect, in terms of our you know, because of course these elections are about local things, but all of us have one eye on what's going to happen later in the year. Hartlepool again, quite a good indicator.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, obviously, it was not that long ago that Hartlepool voted in a Conservative MP, breaking the habit of many, many decades, and that was seen as a real low point for Keir Starmer, wasn't it? But perhaps we're guilty of seeing this all through a Westminster prism. And obviously, Hartlepool has its own council elections, important for their own reasons. Now, in the Northwest, we have Manchester, which I think is maybe the safest Labour council in the country. It's virtually all Labour councillors in Manchester. They have a massive majority. But there are some much tighter councils in other parts of the Northwest, aren't there? Sort of like more towards Lancashire.
Yeah. So again, I'd be looking at places like Pendle, places like Hindburn, both Conservative controlled, both places where if Labour have a really, really, really good night, they could get majorities. More likely, we're looking at moving it to November control. And you'll remember from last year, local elections, the big story was councils going from Conservative control to no overall control, i.e. there's a coalition of people running the council. Sometimes that means that Conservatives are still the largest group and are effectively running it, but they don't have an overall majority. So Pendle and Hindburn. Pendle, there have been some internal issues in the Labour Party. A lot of councillors have resigned there, so that may make that more difficult for Labour to get a majority, might make it more likely to go into a no overall control coalition with independents involved. So yeah, those are the two places I'd be looking at in Lancashire where we could see some change.
Absolutely. And finally, Yorkshire and the Humber, there's a few quite tight ones there, aren't there? Which are the ones we should look out for in that region?
Well, there's always Hull. So Hull's been one of the most interesting electoral battlegrounds in the region arguably in the whole of England for several years. Lib Dems took control back in 22. They've strengthened their position recently, but again, that could change. Calderdale, Labour have a very small majority. It's not clear there's any single party that could challenge that, but could we see it move to an overall control? It's possible. Razor-thin Labour majority in Kirklees. Sheffield, a bit like Hull, the Labour and Lib Dem are sort of level pegging in Sheffield, both currently in a coalition running the council with the Greens. Wouldn't take much to change that one way or the other. So yeah, in quite a lot, quite a fluid situation in Yorkshire.
Jonathan, I'm interested in your view on a slightly different subject, but related. Something that really irritates me as a journalist covering local politics is politicians disguising their election literature as local newspapers to give it more credibility with voters. I feel like I'm seeing a lot of this year. And you know, you see loads of examples of things being posted through the door that have the look of a local newspaper, even the name and the masthead, but actually it's just an advert for a particular political party or a particular politician. I mean, have you noticed that too? And do you think it's a problem, or is it just part of the sort of rough and tumble of political debate?
I have noticed it. Anecdotally, I think there is more of it, though I don't think we have numbers to definitively show that. I think it is a problem. And it's a problem because we are operating in a context in which trust in institutions is in decline. Now, we do, ahead of local elections, we do some polling every year with Ipsos Mori. Only 25% of people trust the UK government to act in the best interest of their local area. Only 26% of people trust the national media to act in the best interests of their local area. So trust is at an all-time low. Trust in local politicians is a bit higher. 43% of people trust local councillors. Trust in local media is higher. 42% of people trust local media. But that's still a minority of people, right? So it's, trust in local institutions is better, but it's fragile. And I think things like the sort of leaflet you're describing really risk damaging that already declining trust. So I think it is a problem, because without trust, the whole democratic system starts to falter. Trust is the currency the democracy works on, and we need to be very careful, I think. Politicians of all parties need to be very, very careful not to undermine trust further than it already is. What I would say to your listeners, Rob, is that you've just got to look at the small print, because it is a legal requirement where you have those kind of fake newspapers. They do have to carry what's called an imprint. So somewhere on there, it should say who it's printed by, who it's printed for, and who funds it. If it isn't, that should be reported to the Electoral Commission immediately. But that's what people should be looking for. If in doubt, scour the flyer for the small print that will tell you who it's actually for and who paid for it.
Always read the small print. Good advice, not just in this situation, but in life in general. Jonathan, thank you so much. So that's Jonathan Carr-West from the Local Government Information Unit. Thank you for coming on. All of us really owe the comparative decency of our lives to poor drudges underground, blackened to the eyes, with their throats full of coal dust, driving their shovels forward with arms and belly muscles of steel. That quote from 1937 in George Orwell's book, The Road to Wigan Pier, sets out very poetically, I think, the lot of the coal miner in pits across the north and nationwide as their dangerous work helped power the UK's industrial might. But in the 90 years since then, the coal mines have largely disappeared, taking jobs and a sense of identity from the coalfield communities that relied on them. And now a report by the Coalfields Regeneration Trust says that 40 years on from the divisive miner strike of the 1980s, fewer so-called quality jobs are available in former coal mining areas than there are elsewhere. The research carried out by Sheffield Hallam University on behalf of the charity felt there had been substantial job growth in former pit areas, but the rate of growth is far slower than in the main regional cities. And in fact, the gap is so stark now that if brought together, the former coal fields would likely be the most deprived region in the UK. It's a fascinating report, I think. So let's hear more about it with Andy Locke, Deputy Chief Executive of the Coalfields Regeneration Trust. Andy, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having us, Rob.
Not a problem at all. It's good to have you on. So just to set the scene for people who are unfamiliar, when we talk about coalfield communities or ex-mining communities, which areas are we talking about in Northern England?
Well, obviously we're a UK charity, so we cover the coalfields of England, Scotland and Wales, but predominantly in the north. So in the northeast, you're looking at Northumberland, Sunderland, South Tyneside, County Durham, and then it sweeps down into Yorkshire, the primary Yorkshire coalfield, Barnsley, Rotherham, Doncaster, Wakefield. Parts of East Leeds was in that mix as well, and a little bit of Sheffield. And then in the northwest, we've got the Wigan and St Helens coalfield. It touches into Merseyside in Knowsley in part. And then in Greater Manchester, you've got a little bit of Bolton and Salford. But then you've got the swathe that touches in West Cumbria as well. So it's in the north, everything above the Midlands, that gives you a good sense of our geography. Yeah.
So it's a massive stretch of Northern England.
It's huge. Yeah.
As coalfield communities. And obviously, you know, millions of people living in these areas. I mean, there's been huge change, hasn't there, since the, well, I mean, in the last century, but particularly since the 1980s, since the miners' strike. So how have these former mining communities changed sort of overall?
Well, I think probably the most obvious thing is if you drive into the coalfield these days, you'll not see any memory of the machinery, the pit tips, anything like that. That's all been remediated and reclaimed. So there's very few physical evidence really of what that what the industry was. I think sort of we were kind of brought in to support the communities. So I guess what we've seen, and it's our 25th year this year. I suppose what we've seen is when you look at some of the more traditional villages, you know, you can drive down those streets and probably what were once thriving high streets, pubs, shops, you know, your butcher, your baker, all the rest of it, they're really struggling. And, you know, you could go down on a Saturday afternoon in a lot of those communities and see shuttered up shops. We know that the health impacts over, you know, the generational unemployment that we've had in a lot of these communities create other socioeconomic impacts as well. So health inequalities is huge. And that's not just about the, it's not just about the men who worked underground, because obviously they are, there are inherent health issues attached to the industry and the generation that's still alive, I guess, who worked in it. They have got those health issues. But we're talking now of people that, because they've been living in areas of high deprivation for quite a long time, our health issues are pretty poor. I suppose one of the things that, you know, you don't want to kind of paint a too negative a picture, because ultimately they are incredibly proud communities, resilient communities. I would say there's been a growth in the voluntary community sector organisations that have stepped in to provide services, activities, supporting those communities where you used to have a lot of the traditional infrastructure, the miners' welfares, the social clubs attached. You know, all those were supported through the subs that the men paid through their wages. Now, a lot of those are, those assets are struggling, but you still have a vibrant community sector, albeit it's under pressure because there are growing needs and challenges in the area that they're trying to respond to.
And you're absolutely right. We don't want to paint a too negative a picture about these mining communities, because, you know, they, as you say, they are in many ways very proud and vibrant places. And as your report states, you know, there has been jobs growth in recent decades, but just not to the same extent as the nearby city. I mean, can you give us a sort of example in the north of how a city is outstripping the economic growth of the nearby sort of coalfield communities?
Okay, so it's probably harder to paint a picture of one individual city, because in the main regional cities anyway, they've seen growth of over 16% over the last 10 years in job growth. Whereas in coalfields, it just nudges over to 12%. So we're four percentage points back on the cities. Now, look, we're sat here, I'm based in Barnsley at the Coalfield Regeneration Trust, but I live in Leeds. And you can look at the skyline of Leeds to determine how much investment's going into there. And then when you go into maybe some of those communities in you know, parts of the South Yorkshire coalfield, you just haven't got that same level of investment going in. So the, you know, the stats are quite stark really on our job. I mean, there's been growth, but we're not saying there hasn't, and that's all really welcomed. But that ripple effect from that investment that's going into the big cities certainly isn't extending to some of those more traditional mining communities that we've been working in for over 20 odd years now.
One line I was really interested in the report, just I guess illustrating how coalfield communities have changed. It says that in some parts of the country, warehousing has become a dominant employer and now employs 175,000 people in the former coalfields, almost as many as the coal industry itself just prior to the 84-85 strike. And, you know, when you drive along the motorway past Barnsley or, you know, up through the northeast, you do see some of these big warehouses. They're hard to miss. I mean, is that a good thing that this new industry has sprung up in its place, or would you rather see something different? Are there sort of limitations on what, you know, the rise of these big warehouses can offer?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you'll see with a lot of the reclamation of the sites, what's been put in that place. Look, for us, jobs are good, right? When you're looking to replace the thousands of jobs that were lost in the industry, it doesn't happen overnight, but by stealth, we've got to a point where particularly areas like Yorkshire and Lancashire, where the connectivity on the motorway networks is good, that's where you've seen that real explosion in warehousing jobs. And I think Yorkshire in the last 10 years has probably got about 26,000 new jobs in warehousing. So look, we're supportive of those jobs because people need to work, right? I think the challenge we have is that it's the quality of some of those jobs and the pay of some of those jobs is lower. And I think, you know, there's probably a balance that needs to be struck. Create those jobs by all means, but look at some of the higher skilled, higher paid jobs that can also create a environment where young people aren't having to sort of leave those areas, go and work in the cities where maybe some of those higher skilled jobs are, and never return to the coalfield. We've got that brain drain situation. And I think the underlying point here is that even though we've had that job growth, we've still got a real low job density in the coalfield. So if you look at national averages, you know, we've got about 57 jobs per 100 people of working age in the coalfield. You go down to the southeast, you're looking at nearly 90 jobs per 100 people in London and the southeast. And in the regional cities, it's well over 70. So those jobs are great, but we still need more of them. What we've been saying is like, okay, well, let's see how we can start to think about the higher skilled jobs that these communities would really benefit from going forward.
So you've set out very very well in the report sort of what the issues are and the disparity that we can see. What do we do about it? And then how well is the government, either at central or local level, doing at, you know, addressing the problems that you've described?
Well, I mean, we think we've come up with our own solution, really, as you probably wouldn't be surprised to hear. We've changed massively. We don't get UK government funding anymore in England. We've been standing on our own two feet for nearly 10 years now. And the way we've done that is through building development property, creating growth space for small to medium enterprises. That's bringing jobs into the areas that need the jobs. And the resultant income from that, we invest that in social impact programs that respond to some of the challenges that the report's highlighted. Now, we've been doing that at a relatively small scale, but we know from the experience we've had is that if you create those units, they'll come. People, we've got businesses in there who are clamoring for small space. So when we be talking about warehousing in the big sheds, there needs to be a balance. We need to create growth space for the new enterprises, the growth companies there that are, you know, the small to medium enterprises, the big employers in our areas. And there isn't the investment going into creating that type of accommodation. And we think there's a real opportunity there for government and the mayoral combined authorities, devolved administrations, to actually back that as a proposal. big can be beautiful, but small can be as well, right? And our experience is very much that you build some quality stuff. We can work with local authorities to determine if there are clusters of particular types of industry that might actually be kind of supply chain potential for some of the bigger companies that come in later years, but ones that actually start to provide some of those higher skilled jobs. We've got a mix of people in those units, but they're all good quality jobs. They're all in areas that need the jobs. One example being Kellingley was the last deep coal mine to close in 2015. We were the first developer on that site. That's a catalyst. We created the infrastructure into that site. There's a huge development going on behind it. But when we completed that and we got support from the Leeds City region, which was fantastic, we've got 32,000 square feet of space there. We've probably got 10, 11 companies in there providing jobs, 70, 80 jobs in that. That's what we need. It needs to be balanced. And we think there's an opportunity there to look at co-investment with local authorities, but also, you know, for them to recognise that just pushing that money into the big urban areas, the cities, right, there's opportunities in the coalfield that we think. We think the communities would really respond to that. We think if we put the right support in there, you can create the pathways and skills to enable people to access those jobs. It gets around some of the connectivity issues you've got from these communities to people to migrate into the cities, where that can be challenging with public transport or the train network. So we think there are solutions there. We need a bit of support to help us scale up that. But I think that's a real potential for the local government devolved administrations to actually start to work with us to see how we can collaborate on that and create some growth in these areas that's much needed.
So are you optimistic, Andy, about the future of coalfield communities?
Well, hopefully you can tell by my voice I'm optimistic. We've seen a lot of changes, as I've alluded to. We can see that with a longer-term approach to investment, recognising that coalfields have some unique qualities, recognising that we've got a legacy of people who are hardworking, but they just want the same opportunities as the average community. We think with that and a certain effort by UK government, devolved administrations, we think we can actually create healthy, vibrant, prosperous communities again for the coalfield. I'm optimistic about that. We're going to continue to push for that. And hopefully, over the next 25 years, when we've seen some of that sustained investment, we won't be having the same conversation about the state of the coalfields report.
Let's hope not. Andy Locke from the Coalfields Regeneration Trust, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks very much, Rob. That's great.
Thank you for listening to the Northern Agenda podcast. And don't forget, you can subscribe to our daily newsletter at thenorthernagenda.co.uk. It's more important than ever for Northern voices to be heard. The Northern Agenda is a laudable production for Reach. It's presented by me, Rob Parsons, and it's produced by Daniel J. McCoughlin. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to The Northern Agenda wherever you listen to your podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. See you next week.